Morning. I'm very sorry for being late. There was a medical emergency on the train. I did send two or three emails, but probably the students are not even here today. Anyhow, today we will be talking about prejudice and discrimination, a very important topic in social psychology. I started my career as a social psychologist doing research on racism and discrimination and prejudice, mainly of Germans on foreign people living in Germany or people with a foreign background. And I will talk about this research and other people's research a little bit today, but also next week. Last week, we discussed leadership and decision-making. The model that explains leadership in terms of unique properties or personality characteristics is known as the personality approach, person-leader match theory, unique person model, or the great person theory? Yes, please. The great person theory, because it's more than just personality. Some personality characteristics, as I told you, extraversion, for example, have been found repeatedly to relate to leadership emergence. But there are also other characteristics, like physical characteristics, height, voice, etc. According to Lippitt and White, which of the following is not a leadership style? Success-oriented, laissez-faire, autocratic, or democratic? Yes, please. A, success-oriented. Remember, Lippitt and White manipulated leaders' behavior in these school clubs with children, and some behaved autocratic, gave commands, and the children obeyed these commands, but performance was reduced when the leader left the room. In democratic groups, the leaders had the children involved in decision-making and assignments of projects, and their children were most satisfied, and performance was high even when the leader was leaving the room. And laissez-faire leaders did not do much or did not do anything, and performance was low in these groups and went up even a little bit when the leaders were not present. The LPC scale is used as a measure of leadership style in democratic countries, sports groups, factory settings, or as part of contingency theory. That's simple. D. What was LPC standing for? Do you remember? Does anyone remember? Yes? Correct, least preferred coworker. And Fiedler's reasoning was that if a leader evaluates his or her group member, team member, he least likes to work with in positive terms, then this leader is probably more person-oriented. And remember, person orientation was good in situations of relatively moderate situational control, whereas task orientation is good in situations with very low or very high situational control. Any questions to last week's session or in general? Last week there was one question after the lecture about the material in the book that I do not cover in the lectures. And yes, the material is relevant for the exam, except for the chapters that I do not cover in the lecture. So there are some chapters like, I think, language or linguistics and other chapters which I do not cover at all. But for the other chapters, you have to read the whole chapter to prepare for the exam, because unfortunately I cannot cover all the material in a 90-minute lecture, but it's still important. And okay. And of course, you can also put notes on your slides in relation to experiments or theories that we do not cover in the lecture, but that you find useful or important when reading the chapter. Okay, so today we will be talking about prejudice and discrimination, and then next week we move forward to intergroup behavior in general. And when we talk about intergroup behavior, I will also come back a little bit to today's session, because I will also involve some reasons for why people engage in prejudice or discrimination. So today we will be talking about the nature of prejudice and discrimination. We focus on particularly forms such as sexism, for example, And then we look at more subtle forms of how people can express their prejudices. And a little bit we also look at the effects of prejudice on people who are stigmatized, and we will discuss some reasons for prejudice. And as I said, we will continue that next week. Prejudice is ubiquitous. It affects all of us. It affects both majority group members as well as minority group members. And the majority is often the ones that hold a prejudice and therefore often respond with discrimination, and minority members are victims of such discrimination. And we can all be minorities in some contexts and majorities in other contexts. You know this adage, jeder ist ein Ausländer, you are a foreigner. When you go elsewhere, you may be a foreigner even in Germany, when you go to a city in which you haven't been before and in which you don't know anyone. Women are obviously not a minority in terms of number, but they can be a minority in terms of power, and we will look at this today in some detail. And women can also be a majority when they discriminate against other people. So we all are affected by prejudice, either because we hold them or because we are victims of them. And this shows that prejudice is quite ubiquitous in 15 different countries of the European Union. We analyzed this data in the 1990s and early 2000s in Marburg. Since then, there was one or two other Eurobarometer studies, but that these newer studies have not used the same items and are not directly comparable. What you can see here is on a scale from 1 to 2, these were 4 items, and each agreement to a statement was half a point, so the maximum was 2, the minimum would have been 1. And you can see that stereotypes vary from country to country, and stereotypes were a little higher in Greece, Belgium, than Germany or Denmark. So Germany is among the top 3 or 4 countries in terms of prejudice. These were questions like, we have too many foreigners in our country, or the foreigners living or coming to our country abuse our social security systems. And you can see that Germany is in the top group, that some countries have less prejudice levels than the countries in the top group, but there's no country with no prejudice at all. And the prejudice levels remained relatively stable, so the correlation between the rank order of the 15 countries across the 2 years was 0.85 or 0.87, so very, very strongly those countries that were high on prejudice in 1997 continued to be high on prejudice 3 years later. This research was conducted by the European Union. It's called Eurobarometer. The Eurobarometer is executed every year, but sometimes the focus is on attitudes like prejudice and discrimination. Sometimes these social psychological concepts are not included. The ninth thing is that the same items are used in every country, and that they draw representative samples. So per country, it's roughly 1,000 people who respond. And for Germany, if you do it well, 1,000 people make a representative sample of our population in terms of age, gender, economic status, education, etc. So prejudice is ubiquitous. But prejudice is also dangerous. It fosters negative consequences from lowered self-esteem of those who are targets or victims of prejudice to genocide. And this is a statistic that we have put together for a paper more than 10 years ago, and which is relatively difficult to put together because there are various statistics about hate crimes in Germany. So hate crime means racially or right-wing motivated crimes that can be registered as any thought of from swastikas painted on walls to murder. So it can be anything along a wide continuum, a wide range. But for the victims, every one of these acts is bad, it's not good. And you can see that in Germany between 1993 and 2005, on average, we have something like 600 or 700 of these hate crimes. And these are only the official statistics. So early on, from 1993 to 1997 or 8, we got these statistics from the Ministry of Interior. Later on, it was much more difficult, and we had to rely on the left-wing party asking the government about these statistics, and then they were released on a monthly basis, and we could put them together. And from 2005, it's almost impossible to get this data. I have checked other statistics and tried to get an overview about the 20 years between 1990 and 2011, and the official record is 60 deaths because of right-wing or racist violence. So 60 people who have been murdered. The unofficial estimates are three times as high. So unofficially, statistics say that up to 180 people were killed because of right-wing extremism or racial motives. And in total, in these 20 years, we can count something like 17,000 hate crimes motivated by right-wing extremism. So prejudice is ubiquitous, and the result of prejudice can be dangerous, can go up until murder and people getting seriously injured or even killed. What are the components of prejudice? What are we talking about? Prejudice itself can be seen as an affective component, as a feeling, and it also comprises a cognitive belief system that we can call stereotypes, and it goes hand in hand with an intention to react, and that would be discrimination. So remember when we talked about attitudes in the third or fourth lecture, I introduced the ABC model, affect, behavior and cognition. And with behavior, we typically do not mean the behavior itself, but behavioral intentions, intentions to discriminate, for example. So the affective component, or the core component of prejudice, is a hostile or negative attitude toward a distinguishable group of people based solely on their membership in that group. A negative feeling or a hostile feeling about some people just because they are members of a certain group. And prejudiced people direct their prejudice towards members of the group as a whole, ignoring the distinguishing characteristics. This is something that has also been called the outgroup homogeneity effect, and this is something that you probably all observe among yourself. When you, for example, think of Asian people, or think of Chinese, or think of Italians, then we automatically have a picture in our view, the ideal picture of a Chinese person or an Italian person. And it's very difficult to see that in reality there's as much variation among any of these groups as it is with a group of Germans. I learned this for the first time when I was teaching Chinese executives in our business school, in the Goethe Business School, and it was a group of 30 managers from the China Development Bank or China Construction Bank it was, and these 30 people were looking so much different. Some were tall, some were rather short, some had broad faces, others had more narrow faces. They came from Mongolia, from the seasides, from inner city, from Tibet, and from all parts of the country, and look very, very different. You can agree to that. But how is the opposite? Before, are you born in China?
Yes.
And when did you come to Europe for the first time?
Last October.
So before you actually arrived in Europe, did you also have like a view of Germans being all relatively alike? And were you also surprised that there are some who are not blonde and tall and...
Mm-hmm. And punk very important here in Germany. Like, I learned this from the German class. Mm-hmm. But not for my personally, I'm not a person that I know that for a long time ago that different person lives in different countries actually. So mm-hmm. we cannot say the person in this country is in this time. For mm-hmm. my personally, I don't have this point of view.
Okay. But that's good. I mean, we should all try to overcome our prejudices or stereotypes, but sometimes it's very hard, and we only know that our stereotypes are wrong once we encounter people in their home countries, and many people don't do that. Next week we will talk about contact theory as one mechanism for explaining higher prejudice and also for reducing prejudice. And the big problem is that those people have the largest stereotypes that don't have any contact to the group they have negative feelings about. So in Germany, for example, in some parts of Eastern Germany where 0% people who are not born in Germany, they have the highest stereotypes, whereas in cities and regions of Germany with 10, 15, 20% of non-German-born population, stereotypes are lowest, because personal experience helps us seeing the heterogeneity in the group that we are talking about. The stereotype is a generalization about a group of people in which identical characteristics are assigned to virtually all members of the group, regardless of the actual variation. Outgroup homogeneity, in-group heterogeneity. That's a typical finding in basic social psychology coming from a cognitive angle. So we typically hold stereotypes that say every Italian likes pasta, regardless of the fact that some Italians would prefer rice or not eat pasta very, very much. And we have the same stereotypes about other minorities or other groups in general. And sometimes a stereotype can be true, or sometimes a kernel of truth is embedded in the stereotype, but often this reflects the group's average and again does not take into account that there is heterogeneity. For example, we had a talk a couple of years ago in our colloquium of someone who is working on diversity and who is consulting organizations, companies about diversity. And he gave us a few examples, and one example was when a first woman was appointed to an IKEA store in the area where the furniture is packed and handled and delivered to the customer. When the first woman was appointed, the male colleagues were complaining because they thought that the woman could not handle the heavy goods. Because the stereotype is that women are physically less strong than men. And on average, this is true. On average, when you take a group of hundreds randomly selected women and compare them to 100 randomly selected men, you will find a mean difference and a significant mean difference in physical strength. But that ignores that there is variation and that there are some women who are stronger than men in these two groups. At IKEA, it turned out that the men were right and that the woman appointed was not able to lift some of the specifically heavy goods. So what they did was they installed some machinery on the ceiling where the goods could be linked to some Flaschenzug. I don't know the English word. And this was good because it also helped the men ultimately finding it easier to use the heavy goods, and they responded with being less ill because they had less often back pains and other physical problems. So in this case, it was actually still good that despite the stereotype, this woman was appointed for the whole group. The difference between the prejudice as the affective component and stereotypes as a cognitive aspect is that stereotypes are not necessarily emotionally laden. and do not necessarily lead to discrimination. But there is a potential of people being abused because they are stereotyped, and this can be quite blatant, quite severe. Discrimination is an unjustified, negative, or harmful action towards a member of a group simply because his or her membership in that group. And I would like to illustrate this with some studies that we have conducted in Marburg and other cities of Germany. And Andreas Klink and Uli Wagner in 1999 published 14 of these experiments. We have conducted more studies in Marburg. Matthias Kauf and Uli Wagner have recently done some similar studies. And we over and over find the same things. So what we do is we do subtle experiments in the cities, in the paper by Klink and Wagner, 14 experiments. The subjects were always German, so people were approaching German citizens in the cities of Marburg or Essen or Duisburg. In Duisburg, for example, 80 passers-by in the city center were asked for directions to the station. And they were asked by a woman that was a Confederate or a PhD student of Uli Wagner at that time, who was of Turkish origin, but in one condition she was dressed with jeans and t-shirt, and in the other condition she wore an old-fashioned skirt and a headscarf. In the Oriental condition, that's the F for foreign, she was more often rejected help than in the German condition. That means that people did not respond to her request showing her the way to the station at all. They just walked on. Or they said, oh, I'm not from Duisburg myself, I cannot help you, or I'm sorry, I'm in a hurry. Much more often, significantly more often, when she was dressed with foreign clothes than when she approached the people with European or German clothes. And there were four studies of this type. In some studies, they were asking people to provide direction. In another study, that was at a time when there were still telephone booths where you needed 30 Pfennig to make a telephone call to someone. So again, we were approaching passers-by and asking them, can you please lend me 30 Pfennig because I need to make an important telephone call. And either this was done by a European German person being dressed as a European, speaking German with no accent, or by a person having different clothing or was speaking with a foreign accent. And all four studies led to significant results in the same direction. Help was more often denied when the person was speaking with an accent or wearing foreign clothing. We wanted also to see whether this would apply to students, because we thought maybe students are a particularly liberal and tolerant group, and maybe the potential for discriminate against foreigners is much lower among students. And in Marburg at that time, we had a board in the students' Mensa where students could put on signs for offering lifts in different cities over the weekend, for example. So people who would go from Marburg to, say, Berlin could say, next week I'm going to Berlin, I would like to leave Friday morning, and I can offer three free spaces in my car, and I would need 10 Deutschmarks as a contribution to the fuel. And then people could put their names on or ring the students. And we made the exact same offer by either someone with a German name or by someone carrying a Turkish name. And again, the offer was far less accepted in the foreign condition than in the German condition. So although it was an identical time, it was the identical destination and an identical price for taking the lift, when students were making this offer with a foreign name, they were less often called than with a German name. We did this also with landlords in the Ruhrgebiet. Here in we had three studies, and two of them were significant, where people were calling offers that for flats that they found in the newspaper, and they were asking for an appointment for seeing the flat. And when they were calling with a foreign accent and not a German accent, or not speaking with an accent, they were told, no, the flat is already rented, you are too late. We obviously randomly changed the order, whether we first called with the German voice and no accent, and then called with a non-German accent or foreign accent, and sometimes we switched the order around. And sometimes it happened that people first called with a foreign accent, they were told, no, the flat is already rented, and when we called with no accent 5 minutes later, we were getting an appointment for seeing the flat. And this is one of the most important or most interesting studies, I think. This lost letter technique was also developed by Stanley Milgram, the one who conducted the obedience studies. So you lose a letter somewhere, and then all you do is you see how many letters are picked up by someone finding the letter, putting it in a post box, and arriving at its destination. And we left the letters in one of these telephone booths in Marburg, and we did another study in another city, and both studies were significant. The letter was apparently an important letter because the address was going to a lawyer, and the letters had a stamp on it, and the only difference was that the sender was having a German or a Turkish name. And what we did we counted the people going into the telephone box and returning from the telephone box without taking the letter and putting it in a telephone box, in a post box. And obviously we also counted the number of letters actually arriving. And what we found was in both studies, the letter with a foreign name was left in the telephone booth and not put in a post box compared to the German name. In one condition, someone took the stamp from the letter with the foreign name and left it where it was. And we were the police was coming to our office one day because we were accused of wrongly using the name of a lawyer, which was not our intention, and we had to promise that we never again would do that. So 14 studies, 9 of them were significant. In no single study was the effect in the opposite direction, neither significant nor insignificantly. And Klink and Wagner also conducted a meta-analysis across these 14 studies, and the meta-analytic average effect obviously was significant and in the direction that foreigners were more often refused help and discriminated against. Now, and this is interesting, but it does not necessarily tell us whether people hold stereotypes about foreigners speaking with a foreign accent, wearing a headscarf, having a Turkish name. In many of these experiments, yes, it might be that the flat was already rented out. It might be that students called the one with the German name for reasons other than prejudice and stereotypes. And therefore, we have done some follow-up studies in which we did similar experiment. So, for example, we asked people who were coming out of a supermarket for giving us 30 pfennig for making a telephone call, again, in half of the condition speaking with an accent and the other half of the condition not speaking with the accent. And then the passers-by or the people leaving the supermarket who were approached by us walked on, and somewhere along the street we were approaching them as students of the Marburg University, asking them to help us completing a small survey. And this small survey had just 6 or 7 items, starting with some items about environmental attitudes, attitudes against environmental pollution or traffic in the city center. And some questions were about prejudice against foreigners in Germany. And what we found was marginally significant results, so that those who rejected help to foreigners in the first part of the experiment also had less positive attitude than the other half of the experiment. The problem is that you don't get all the sample because some people are really in a hurry and don't participate in the first or in the second part of the experiment. In general, I also have to say that most people do help. Most people do give 30 pfennigs. So the number of people who do not help is relatively small. And of those who do not help, there is less help against someone approaching them with a foreign name or accent or clothes. But you have to compare these people with those who help in the foreigner condition. And we would have to run much, much larger experiments to find statistical significance and robustness. But I think there are some good reasons to assume that people less help the foreigners in all these different experiments because they are skeptical about foreigners. This does not say that they are blatant racists. Okay, so people do have prejudice, and they may or may not be expressed in overt behavior such as discrimination. Yes, please. I'm not sure. I really cannot say. But those who helped us in the experiment where we collected 30 pfennigs or so, I don't think we debriefed them because this would have been complicated. But I do think we donated the money to some charity. This is what we often do when it's about money. Maybe today I would do it differently, but the question also is what do you tell them? You were just part of an experiment and you haven't given money to someone who wasn't... So particularly those that complete surveys, they should be asked whether you can use the data. I think for many of the others, it's difficult. Also, the lost letter experiment. So we just count the people going into the telephone box and we have a look and see whether the letter is still there. And I think it would probably be more disturbing running after the people and telling them, oh, we just did an experiment. You didn't know that you were part of it. And we just recorded you left the letter there. It would be interesting also to do that to find out what people would say as an excuse or reason or motivation, what they thought when they were seeing the letter. Maybe today we would do that a little differently. I think in the experiments of Kauf and Wagner, it was voting decisions. So in one experiment, at least, it was a student sample, and they were presented candidates for the ASTA, and they were asked whether they would vote for them or not, and there was no vote, there was no ASTA election at the time. So I think that's very unobtrusive and subtle, and you don't do any harm to anyone. So when we talk about prejudice, and both in the real world, what we see is most pervasive and which stereotypes are typically held by a sizable number of people, but also what has been in the attention of researchers is stereotypes and prejudice based on sex, race, ethnicity, age, sexual orientation, but also people with physical or mental special needs. And in most Western nations, legislation and social attitudes have significantly reduced these prejudices, but not completely. And this legislation, for example, in Germany is the AGG, Allgemeines Gleichstellungsgesetz, which prevents organizations from discriminating against people from any minority. And I think particularly in Germany, this had a positive effect, but there's also still a long way to go. There are still only pilot studies in organizations, for example, that experiment with blind application processes, where people apply with their credentials and accomplishments and certificates, but don't reveal their age, sex, or ethnic group membership. And that makes it more likely for women to make it into well-paid and leadership positions. This makes it more likely for older people finding re-employment. It makes it more likely for people from ethnic minorities to be invited to an interview. So I think all these things are good, and some organizations are experimenting with them, like Telecom, for example, I know, had a big project with that and are finding it useful. But for many other organizations, including public organizations like our university, it's not standard. When I applied at Aston University in Birmingham in 2002, it was standard in the whole country. Every university had to do it that way, which I think is good. You may have heard about some orchestras that traditionally would only appoint male people, and then the first female musicians were challenging these orchestras in court, and then they were told, no, you have to have women, and there were still no women appointed because those who did the auditions said that the women were not as good musicians. And now I think some orchestras do a blind audition where men and women candidates perform behind a curtain, and this led to more and more women being appointed to orchestras as professional musicians. So there's still a long way to go, and we do see still a lot of prejudice based on people's gender in Germany. This is something I found in 1997, Was Frauen sich wünschen. Bauknecht weiß, was Frauen wünschen. This was an adage in the 1950s or 60s, and it's still active. And it's a little booklet of 20 or 30 pages, and some of it is a bit humorous and funny, but it's successful because it still matches our stereotypes about women wanting beauty products and jewelry and all of these things. And that Bauknecht can help us understand. And this leads to women entering leadership positions less often than men. This leads to women still being paid less than men. The pay gap, the gender pay gap, is still around 20% in Germany. It goes down when you account for a number of factors like full-time or part-time work, and whether the job people are doing is in male or female-dominated industries or sectors. So in childcare and nursing, average salary is lower, both for men and women, than in jobs that have to do with engineering, for example. But even if you account for these factors, there's still a pay gap between 3 and 8%, depending on where we are looking at. So even if a man and a woman are doing the same job, same full-time or part-time profession in the same industry, there's still a gender pay gap. And this results from prejudices, from stereotypes. And on the one hand, you can also say that accounting for these factors is not necessarily making it fairer or making it better. So, for example, the fact that women are more often in part-time employment than men because they also have to provide childcare and do all the homework does not make it better that the pay gap is reduced once we account for this fact. Or that professions in education and in caring for either young or the old are paid less. That's a problem in and of itself, and it does not make the pay gap better if we make it smaller, controlling for these factors. There's one interesting study by economists who have found that the gender pay gap goes away under one very specific circumstances. I think it was US economists who studied the top 500 companies in the country, and what they found was there was no pay gap in the organizations of which the CEO had a firstborn female child. So when you are a CEO, it's very likely that you are a man, and your first child is a daughter, then this seems to motivate you to reduce any discrimination in the areas where you can influence it. When we got our first child, I was a part-time PhD student in Marburg University, and my wife was a full-time primary school teacher. So we decided that after 3 months, I would stay home and my wife would go back to full-time work because she was earning more money and was providing the rent of our apartment. And I could negotiate with my supervisor, with my boss, that I could come into the office later every afternoon and still work on my PhD. My mother and father only had two children, and both were boys, me and my younger brother. My wife's parents only had two girls, my wife and her younger sister. So when we told them about our decision, my mother was asking us, oh, why does she have to go back to work so early? Do you not earn enough? That was me. My parents, my wife's parents asked us, why do you stay at home for 3 months? Wouldn't it be better to go back to work after the 6 weeks or so, what is it called? I don't know. Because they wanted the best for their daughter and didn't want her to have her career interrupted, whereas for my parents, it was the old traditional view of men earning, being the breadwinners and earning the money to provide for the family. And this is also one of the problems of the pay gap, that women, more often than men, interrupt work in the critical stages between 25 and 35 years because of childcare and because they take leave of absence or maternity leave for 1 or 2 or 3 years. And that leads women to miss out climbing the career ladder early on. And if it's just one step on the career ladder that women are behind men because of these 1 or 2 or 3 years break, they never make up the differences in payment over the 30 or 40 years in the career that follow. Yeah, and sometimes the corporate ladder just looks different for men and women, and this is causing a lot of problems. And as I said, having gender-blind interviews, gender-blind recruitment procedures is already a first but important step in making the recruitment process more fair. So we have legislation, as the Allgemeine Gleichstellungsgesetz, but also social disapproval. When you would raise blatant prejudice against minority groups, whatever sort of, you would probably be frowned on by your peers, by your colleagues, or by your teachers, or by your neighbors. It's not socially approved of to be blatantly prejudiced in many areas. And this has inhibited or reduced more overt, more blatant, or more extreme expressions of prejudice. But it's more difficult to detect when it's expressed more covertly or in restricted contexts and often go almost unnoted in everyday assumptions, language, and discourse. And that's why it's important to refer to both genders when we announce a certain position. This is important when we think about how can we include men and women, older and younger people, ethnic groups, more into the job market in Germany, for example. I recently read a report about this private organization who was looking for the first female astronaut, a German female astronaut, and originally their job ad was, did you always dreamt of being an astronaut? We may have a good job for you. And they only received two or three applications of women. Then they changed the announcement to, are you a successful biologist, physicist, and do you love your research, and do you want to conduct it on a higher level? And they received 300 to 400 applications by women. Why? Because it is not necessarily a 5-year or 10-year or 12-year-old girl's dream to become an astronaut, to become a pilot, to become someone in that profession. Because women, or small girls and girls, are not educated by their parents, by the media, by fairy tales, by grandparents, etc., etc., that it is a women thing to become an astronaut. So you have to change the way how you think about people, how you approach people, and be considerate of our everyday assumptions, the language that we use, the discourse that we engage in. Yes, please.
Mm-hmm. Businesses, for example, or if I still have like the prejudice that all Nazis or right-wing sympathizers are stupid idiots. Mm-hmm. That's a prejudice, but it's still my personal experience. Mm-hmm. So something with prejudice in ways that experience.
That's a good question, and of course personal experiences are, if you make negative personal experiences with certain people and then avoid these people, this is something that is at the root of prejudice and stereotypes, and this is why this has survived in evolution. It was functional 200,000 years ago to make a very fast decision who you could trust and who not. And when these people were having a slightly different skin color or wearing different hairstyle, then you knew this person is probably from another tribe and it's dangerous if I get close to him, so I better get away. And we had to make these decisions in a split second and could not think about this. And this, why it is functional, and why we still think in categories, and we do that very quickly. So stereotypes helps us coping with a diverse environment and helps us making decisions quick. But if we make experiences with people, then they lead to the association we have between people from one specific groups and our response to it stronger, and lead us to automaticize our responses to it. And sometimes this is helpful, sometimes this is good, but sometimes we have to actively think about whether the experiences we made is really a representative sample of what we draw, or whether it's a one-off example, and it may well be that the next person we encounter is disconfirming our stereotype. And this is something we don't normally do. So we don't take the chance of finding out whether there is actually the heterogeneity that we can assume is true for every group. So I think that even people who have voted for the AfD in the last federal election are a great heterogeneity of people. They are not all like conservative, right-wing extremists. Some of them may have voted just to protest. Some of them may have voted because of the AfD's policy against the euro and the way Schäuble and Merkel deal with it. Some of them may have even left-wing motives that are difficult to understand but may still be there. So we have to assume that this group is heterogeneous. And what I sometimes feel is very difficult in modern times is that we are all living in our own little bubbles. Like we are receiving Facebook news only from the people we like, and once there is something we don't like or don't understand, we unfriend this person so that we don't receive the news anymore. And this makes us think that the way we think and we see the world is normal and representative of how the world really is. But I think it's much more complex and complicated. And sometimes the subtleties are also relevant. And so even if I would find it difficult to be friends with people who have a very different political opinion, it is still mandatory to give every new person we encounter a new chance and try to find out whether this person represents some of the left or right spectrum of the heterogeneity and not represents the average of the group mean that we may have, through experiences, found rightly being different from the mean of our own group. Yeah, please. No. Because you're not acting out on your prejudice. Also with stereotypes, as I said, stereotypes may be true. They may be a kernel of truth, or they may be true in absolute terms. On average, it's more likely that an Italian has black hair. On average, German people are blonde. But for the next person I may meet, I should see for myself whether it's a blonde or a dark-haired person. And hair color is just an example. I think you first, and then...
I was wondering if you realize that you do have a prejudice and you feel uncomfortable about it. For example, I once saw a Turkish family going to the first class on the train, and just the fact that I realized it made me think about it a lot, because I usually didn't know that I somehow seemed to have a prejudice and I didn't like that. About how can I change this, and until now I didn't come up with any solution. So how can we change those prejudices we don't actively act out, but we know that somehow are wrong?
We have to actively make an effort to do so, and even if it's difficult. But I think normally we are not every day in situations if we have to make important decisions about other people's lives or well-being. So we don't normally every day are in a situation in which we recruit people for a job. And in these situations, it's obviously much, much more important that we are aware of our prejudices or stereotypes and that we actively try to reduce them in organizations. But also, I think these petty things, like not showing someone from another group the right direction, not giving him or her little help, is very negative to the people who encounter that every day. And therefore, of course, also in these situations, we should be aware of our prejudice being sometimes or often wrong and unjustified. But yes, it's difficult. It's not so easy because increases cognitive dissonance, and we try to reduce cognitive dissonance. Yes, please.
Is discrimination justified if there are true stereotypes? Or?
It depends what you mean. So, for example, my example was women being physically less strong than men on average. Does not justify women not being appointed to jobs that require physical strength. That's what the Allgemeine Gleichstellungsgesetz says. You cannot discriminate against people of different gender, age, etc., even if there's a mean difference. I think there are only two or three occupational groups in Germany in which you can look for a man or a woman specifically. And all other... So I think it's people selling women's underwear, there you can say, I'm looking for a female salesperson in our store, and you can discriminate against men because you want to prevent the female customers from being exposed to men and therefore the organization's losing business. So even if there are mean differences in terms of physical strength or other things, you cannot discriminate against men because the mean difference does not tell us anything about the distribution around the mean, and it is likely that you, when you announce a position openly and don't discriminate against women, for example, those apply who are physically stronger than the average woman is. I'm not sure. I think the reason probably is that there's the stereotype that there's a higher likelihood of homosexuals carrying HIV, or what may be the reason for this. But as far as I know, blood is tested anyways before it is used and split in its parts, and then so we could still not discriminate against homosexuals and not use the blood if it turns out that there's an illness, because people are also tested for all sorts of illnesses before the blood is actually used. So I don't think that people are excluded from donating blood who have spent some holidays in Asia and may have carried or caught some hepatitis or other viruses. And so you would not say we exclude anyone from donating blood who has been to Thailand in the last year or so, or I don't know. Yeah. Yes, please.
Okay. And then you're allowed again. So it's only temporary.
Okay.
But I think that's different from saying that homosexuals can't donate blood, because it's something else. I mean, it's not about sexual orientation or something. And I think if you just say that everyone has to do to test their own blood for diseases or infections or whatever, then you don't have to discriminate between sexual orientation, because there are still people that are heterosexual and have high
yeah blood. Sure, that's what I meant. I mean, the argument is not correct, because it assumes or it attributes certain behaviors to everyone of the group, regardless of this person's individuality and nature. But I didn't say that everyone should test their blood before going.
No, but that they test the blood.
Yeah, and then okay. They can make a decision afterwards. There was. But I don't think that's anywhere remotely being true.
Well, homosexuals do have a higher possibility of having HIV.
Yeah, but the possibility is still very low in any given number of homosexuals going to donate blood. That would justify excluding these people as a group.
Thank you.
Okay, but still does not say anything about an individual. I think I should have a discussion with some medical experts about this and maybe how this is explained and justified and whether there were any court appeals and whether this... Yes, please. So that means when you
automatically has lots of so for example their less multiple is complaining a lot about this kind of
I must admit I've never donated any blood, but if you do so, are you asked whether you have many different sexual partners, and when you say yes and they send you away again?
He said
okay, but I think this is an interesting example because it tells us that prejudice or stereotypes can sometimes be justified. There's a kernel of truth. There are numbers that you could compare, and you see there are different proportions of HIV-positive people in homosexuals versus heterosexual people. And then you can calculate the costs, and there may be the decision to exclude some people from donating blood. But I still think it's not morally justified in my sense. And there should be other methods of giving people the individuality they deserve and have a decision about whether to use the blood or not after having tested. Okay. So sometimes it's legislation, sometimes it's social disapproval, and we do see that prejudice and other forms of negative attitudes towards certain groups goes down. This is research we have done together with Wilhelm Heidmeier from Bielefeld University. It was called Gruppenbezogene Menschenfeindlichkeit or group-related enmity. And there are very nice and interesting books every year published by Heidmeier between 2003 and 2012. So the first data were collected in 2002. And then for 10 years, we collected the same type of data with between 2,000 and 3,000 people in Germany that made representative samples. And it's called group-related enmity because one thing the project found was that it seems to be a syndrome of having negative attitudes about all sorts of minorities or people. So we found strong associations between people having sexist attitudes, racism, anti-Semitism, prejudice against foreigners living in Germany or people with a non-German background, also attitudes towards homeless people or the unemployed. It seems to be a syndrome that these negative attitudes all go together and correlate strongly with each other and are partly predicted by the same factors like authoritarianism and other things that we talk about later on today and next week. And what you see here is that all these negative attitudes seem to peak in the years 2004, 5, and 6, and then go down a little bit. And then in 2011, there was a small increase again. So this was when the financial crisis kicked in, and Heidmeier and colleagues say because of the financial crisis also made people aware of higher risks to become unemployed, etc., prejudice and all the other forms go up again. But this was at a time when Germany was doing economically relatively well. So after the crisis in the early 2000s and then Schröder and the Agenda 2010. And so in these years, unemployment rates in Germany went down for the first time for 15 years or so. And you see that this has effects on people's attitudes, and they were largely becoming more positive. If we see that in a much broader picture, in the US in 1933, there was a general survey of all sorts of people, also a representative survey, and this is a number of respondents calling black people ignorant, lazy, or superstitious. And you see, if we take the lazy, for example, 75%, three-quarters of respondents were saying that black people are lazy. This study was conducted again in 1951, and you see that the attitude of black people being lazy sharply declined. So now only 25% of people would call black people lazy. And then DuVideo, Jack DuVideo and colleagues repeated this study a couple of times, and you see that this further declined, and in 1993, there were hardly any people calling black people lazy. And the question is, does this reflect the true decline in people's negative attitudes about black people? Or does it more reflect the knowledge that it is socially not desired or approved of to call people lazy in these sorts of public service? And some people say old-fashioned racism indeed has declined. So there's a truly more positive attitudes, and white people endorse racial equality genuinely and think it's the right thing to do. Also, anti-Semitism has declined if we look at it in the wider picture over the last 50 or 60 years. Anti-gay prejudice is declining also in the US on average and in general. Or has declined over the last 40 years. Some of these negative attitudes are gaining momentum again over the last couple of months. But is this apparent decline real or illusory? And some of the researchers have tried to answer the question with using different methods of asking people about their prejudice. So, for example, you could simply do a face-to-face interview, or you could do an anonymous survey. And if you do that, in most of the areas that have been studied, there are little differences in prejudice when you use face-to-face interview or more anonymous surveys. And this leads some researchers to say the decline has apparently been real, because otherwise people would give more positive descriptions when interviewed face to face, where social disapproval is a much stronger factor, but they would reveal their true, more negative attitudes when studied more anonymously, in which we don't have to fear for being socially disapproved by others. And other researchers believe that this old-fashioned racism or sexism or any other concept has been more replaced by more symbolic, subtle forms of prejudice and racism. And symbolic racism, for example, reflects a false belief that discrimination is no longer a major obstacle in the US, for example, against black people or for black people. So whites may not say that black people are lazy, but they may say that, oh, well, there is no discrimination in our country anymore. Ku Klux Klan is dead, and every black person, when they try hard enough, can become everything they want to. And when you explain to them the fact that black people are not represented, for example, in leadership positions or at top universities as much as white students or white people, then they may say, yeah, blacks just don't try hard enough. But in principle, they could. In principle, there is no discrimination. And because of this attitude, they also reject special treatments for certain minority groups, such as affirmative action programs. And if we if we measure people's symbolic racism, then it correlates with the more blatant or traditional forms of prejudice, but it predicts people's responses, for example, to affirmative action policies better than the old-fashioned form because there's more variation. And similar concepts have been applied to other prejudice. For example, there's now a concept called neo-sexism. So hardly or few men agree to very blatant sexist statements about women. But neo-sexism is about that women require special treatments because they are the weak sex, that women should concentrate on certain things like childcaring because nature has made them so. There's also a concept of benevolent sexism, so that people are particularly chivalrous to women, open the door for them, or tell them that they would drive the car so that the woman does not have to do the job or work of driving a car. And in some areas it may be ridiculous. Why should I not keep a door open for a woman? But these types of benevolent sexism, again, correlate with the more traditional forms of sexism as well. So someone who is always keeping the door open for a woman, but not for other men, would also more likely agree to the more traditional forms of sexism. But it's easier to study, because today, if you deliver a survey, particularly to student populations, you will not detect the old-fashioned hard forms of sexism anymore, but you will find variations in benevolent or neo-sexist attitudes, and they may be good predictors of people's responses to affirmative action programs to women. Another modern form of prejudice is aversive racism. This results from, on the one hand, support for racial equality, but at the same time we have these mixed feelings towards people from these minority groups. So in the US, aversive racism leads whites to avoid blacks because they feel ashamed of this component of having some negative feelings. And avoiding blacks in the first place allows them to protect their self-image as being unprejudiced. And it may also allow whites to discriminate against blacks when there is a plausible, non-racist justification for doing so. This is a study that Sam Gartner and Jack DeVito have conducted with women participants in the laboratory. So female students were invited to the laboratory. They were shown through a room in which a confederate of the experimenter was waiting and was introduced as another participant for another experiment. And then the real participant crossed the room and waited in the next adjoining room. And this participant either waited in the room alone or with two other confederates of the experimenter being described as other research participants. Now, in the first room, the confederate was either black or white. In the second room, the real participant waited alone or with two other people. And then, at some stage, there was some noise of chairs falling down and a scream of the confederate in the first room. And the question was, what does the real participant do? Does she get up, look into the other room whether she could help, or would she remain seated and ignore the signs that there was something going on in the other room that could be an emergency? We will discuss this in the session on prosocial behavior, and this is an example of the bystander effect. What we typically find is that people help less when other people are around. And I will explain the mechanisms of that in more detail in a couple of weeks. So when the victim was white, you see that there's a little bit of this bystander effect. So when no other potential helpers were around, 80% of the participant got up and looked whether she could help or not. And when two other potential helpers were around, this went down to 75% or so. So this is a classic bystander effect. And what you see is that if there was no condition of other potential helpers, you would interpret the results as white people are helped as often as black people. There even seems to be a slightly more chance for the black victim to find help than for the white victim. So if there was no potential excuse for not helping the black victim, there was no discrimination. There would not be any evidence of the white Confederates in this experiment in the late 1970s being prejudiced against black people. But if you look at the condition in which a black victim was crossed with two other potential helpers being in the room, help went down dramatically compared with all three other conditions to just 30%. So it went down from a baseline of something like 75 or 80% to under 30%. Because now participants had an excuse that was non-racist. Why should I help? There are other people in the room. Or probably there is no emergency because the other people also don't do anything. So you had an non-racist, unbiased, unprejudiced excuse for not helping. And this is how aversive racism sometimes is studied. We already talked a little bit about modern forms of measuring people's prejudices or negative attitudes in the session of attitudes, and I suggested to you to have a look at harvard.implicit.edu. And there's a lot of enthusiasm in social psychology. For 20 years now, since the IAT has been developed, this is used in many, many studies. However, not all of the standard criteria for good measurement are fulfilled by the IAT. So we don't know about reliability. We don't know about retest reliability. We don't know about all sorts of the validity aspects that we normally would study for a test with items or statements or more traditional forms of measurement. So there are meta-analyses now that tell us that implicit stereotypes can actually predict people's behavior, but also the relation between implicit and explicit attitudes is significant but relatively modest. It's 0.20 or 0.25. So yes, we do measure something, and yes, maybe we do so reliably, and there's some information on validity because it can predict people's behavior, but all this information is not perfect and not what we normally would expect for the tests we are using. I think we already discussed this in the session on attitudes. So typically you cross black and white faces with positive and negative attributes, and in the stereotype consistent combination you would have black faces and negative attributes on the same key and white faces and positive attributes on another key. In the stereotype inconsistent combination you would switch around the condition, and then typically what we find is that people are particularly, those people who have higher prejudice or stereotypes are particularly slow at matching positive words with they are particularly slow at matching positive words with the group that we study prejudice on. So here's black people. It can also be older people. For those younger ones that are doing the test, it can be sexual orientation, religious orientation, etc. So this is a typical finding, that there's little difference for the negative attitudes, but there's a reliable difference on average for the positive words and the minority groups being much slower than the positive words and the majority group. So again, I would really encourage you to do some of these tests yourself and experiment a little bit with the IAT. Now, obviously, what we've discussed mostly is the majority holding prejudice. But what happens to the minority groups, to the victims of discrimination? They can suffer material disadvantages, like the gender pay gap, like not getting into leadership positions, like not getting a flat or help. So it can lead to material disadvantage, and this can also lead to psychological problems, psychological experiences of being less worth, less helped, and this can lead to low self-esteem and the experiences of stigma. And this is the classic experiment that is often used to explain this or to demonstrate this. It was conducted by Rosenthal and Jacobson, and they entitled the paper that they have written as The Pygmalion Effect, after George Bernard Shaw's play on Dr. Doolittle and making a lady from the London lower social class speaking with a posh accent and sophisticated language, and that making her being recognized of a member of the society, at least for a while. So what Rosenthal and Jacobson do, and since then we also call the effect the Rosenthal effect, or the a self-fulfilling prophecy, they measured children's intelligence, elementary school children, second and third grade, and they measured the children's intelligence, and then for 20 of those children told the teachers that these children were bloomers. Bloomers meaning that they would most likely gain in intelligence because they have a high potential. In fact, these 20 children were randomly selected. And as you can see, after 1 year, there was actually... And there was no difference. They were randomly selected. At the time of the test, there was no difference in intelligence between the bloomers and the non-bloomers. But you can see that after the first year, those who were introduced to the teachers as gaining in IQ, the bloomers, indeed had IQ gains that were much higher than those that were described to the teachers as non-bloomers. So you see that both groups gained in IQ. This is what you would expect in elementary school. This is what school is good for, helping children learning new skills and bringing their abilities to the fore. And you see that the effect was still there in the second year. So one full year after Rosenthal and Jacobson had introduce the children as bloomers or non-bloomers. Why is this? Because the teachers treated the children differently. They asked them maybe the more challenging tasks. They gave them the more interesting things to work on. They treated them probably more on eye level and not as children who were stupid. And you see that it can have positive effects on the light blue bars, but it does have negative effects on the people that we do not expect well. And this is what ethnic minority group members experience. This is what women experience who decide to study MINT subjects. This is what elderly people in the workplace experience, because there are so many stereotypes and prejudices. And because these prejudices and stereotypes make people treat them less positively, and this leads them to underperform and not make it to their full potential. Because, as I said, there was no IQ differences at all between the two groups at the start of the experiment. And when one of the non-bloomer group would have been chosen to be a bloomer, they would have experienced gains in IQ as the other group did. Okay. Explanations. Why do we have these prejudices? And one big explanation is frustration. Because we are frustrated that we don't get as much as we think we deserve, we project our negative attitudes, our hate toward those in authority on minority members. However, this cannot explain all sorts of prejudice, because we also find prejudice of people who are economically doing extremely well, who are not frustrated in terms of having a good job, having a good house, etc. So sometimes it's also prejudiced personalities, like the authoritarian personality. Some people want the strong man, want to be ruled by a strong person, and they want that all rules and regulations are accepted and everyone who violates these rules should be punished severely. And authoritarianism has been put forward as a main argument by Adorno to explain the success of the Nazis. Adorno and colleagues said the Germans at that time were very high in authoritarianism. And yes, it may be true, although in other countries there was also high authoritarianism in the 1930s and people didn't vote for the equivalent of the Nazis in their countries. And also it cannot easily explain why it was specific groups that were most severely prejudiced, like the Jews. So we also need to take into account more intergroup explanations. And we will discuss some intergroup explanations next week. So relative deprivation, perceived competition for material goods, this is something we talk about next week. This is in terms of the frustration model. There are few goods, we compete about them, and when we don't get them, we feel relatively deprived, and that leads us to hate other groups. Intergroup anxiety, authoritarianism, social dominance orientation, these are more the personality differences that some people are more anxious and therefore also more prejudiced. Some people believe in the strong man, or some people believe in the differences in hierarchy between layers of society and therefore have higher prejudices. Mass media, nationalism has been studied quite frequently, so nationalists are also more prejudiced, and we do see that in Europe and elsewhere in the world a lot more than we have seen it 10, 15, 20 years ago. And my favorite explanation is that when people don't have personal experiences, when they don't have contact, then they are more strongly prejudiced. And I will tell you more about this next week. Thank you very much.